From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we are positioned at the edge of quite a moment in history. And we have been following the historic news today that President Trump, upending decades of U.S. policy, declared that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and would eventually move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He spoke at the White House and here refers to a U.S. law drafted to declare Jerusalem the capital city, but waived by presidents every 6 months as they wait for stalled peace talks to finish.
After more than two decades of waivers, we are no closer to a lasting peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. It would be folly to assume that repeating the exact same formula would now produce a different or better result. Therefore, I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Before the speech began, protests erupted in Gaza and the Palestinian territories, with Palestinians burning American and Israeli flags, along with photos of President Trump. We're joined now by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, on the other hand, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is calling it an historic day. Tell us more about some of the other reaction.
Right. So primarily in Israel, we're seeing this positive response. It's a big prize. It's something not only Netanyahu and his supporters, but other Israelis and his previous Israeli governments have wanted. But again, we're hearing this strong reaction from the Palestinian, from other Arabs, from other Muslims, again, because Jerusalem is a place that resonates throughout the world, a very important Muslim holy site, as well as Jewish and Christian holy sites. So it's not just a local issue. And we're seeing this throughout the Arab world. Also, the European countries have warned against this move as well.
Well, but he took great pains to say that the future borders of Jerusalem would be determined by the Palestinians and the Israelis.
That's right. So he was very clear. We're not judging the final status issues, Jerusalem being one of those very key issues. However, he gave the Israelis a very big prize here. He really didn't give the Palestinians anything to latch on to say, hey, we see a road ahead and, okay, you're doing this, which the Israelis like. What are you offering us? And it really was just sort of one-sided in providing the Israelis something they consider very important, not offering the Palestinians a clear road ahead.
Well, and what exactly happens? Because the Palestinian leadership is somewhat based in, you know, East Jerusalem. The Knesset, you know, many of the government offices for Israel are in Jerusalem. But will this open a rush to, you know, put some sort of boots on the ground to further, you know, stamp out Israeli ownership of the city? I mean, what happens?
Well, the key point here is Israel has made Jerusalem a more Israeli city ever since they captured the eastern part of the city 50 years ago in the 1967 war. So Jewish Israelis have moved into the east side of the city. Israel controls it in terms of security. The Palestinian leadership is in Ramallah in the West Bank, which is an adjacent city. Palestinians say it's very difficult for them to get ordinary things like building permits. They have kids that grow up and want to stay in the city. They can't find housing. They can't get building permits. So this, you have to see this as part of a 50-year Israeli effort to make the city more Jewish. And the Palestinians see this as just the latest move to sort of push them out of the city or give them less of a presence or a future claim to the city where they want a capital for a future Palestinian state.
Well, and that's the politics, but behind all of this is the faith. And there are so many faiths that lay claim to this city, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, also evangelical Christians. And it was interesting that standing right behind President Trump during his speech was Vice President Pence, who, of course, is an evangelical Christian. Talk about those passions that might be inflamed here as well.
Right. So evangelical Christians in the U.S. have developed a very strong bond with Israel, and they're very supportive of this move. They see it as part of the face that go together in their way, and they believe that Jerusalem is a Jewish city and that it should be recognized as such, and they're supportive of this, even though, ironically, there is a small Christian community in Jerusalem. It's shrunk quite dramatically, but they're mostly Arab Christians.
Right.
So there has been this sort of strange relationship, but evangelical Christians, very supportive of what's happened today.
Well, and of course, as we said, just passions on all sides as to what this space means, which is why many have thought the city should be more shared. But we will continue to follow this story in the aftermath of the president's speech. NPR's Greg Murray, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, back here in the United States, wildfires continue to rage in Southern California, where nearly 200,000 people have been ordered to evacuate. The largest and most destructive fire has burned across thousands of acres in Ventura County, north of Los Angeles. And early this morning, another fire began near the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, not far from Interstate 405. Winds are expected to pick up later today. John Sepulvedo of KQED is in Los Angeles near the Getty Museum. Hi there, John.
Hi.
So first of all, just describe to us what you're seeing. What's the situation there?
I'm seeing apocalyptic dark smoke rise from one of the most iconic areas in Los Angeles. This is the home of the Getty Center, the home of one of the most valuable art collections in the world. What we're seeing is a lot of emergency personnel rushing in to try and stop the fires. We're seeing a lot of evacuations. I'm right next to a hotel that's near the 405 freeway, and folks are being asked to leave. They're being handed white masks. They're being told to grab their luggage and get out. There is just incredible concern that this fire is going to spread. And it's a big deal anytime a highway shuts down in Los Angeles. It's especially a big deal when it's on the 405, and we're seeing a total shutdown of the south or of the northbound lanes on the 405, which is creating a traffic snarl. So I'm seeing lots of traffic, both in the cars, from evacuees, and of police and firefighters as they respond to this fire in Los Angeles.
Wow. So the effect of this fire could reach far beyond the actual location that it's at because of the problem with Interstate 405. But tell us more about exactly where this fire is located. What else is around there that's making this such a dangerous event?
Well, this is just a hotbed of fuel. You have a lot of trees that grew a lot during the heavy downpour about a year ago and then got hit by the summer's intense drought. So there's a lot of vegetation that is dry and ready to burn. And that's something that we're seeing not just here in Los Angeles, but all across the Southland, all across Southern California. A lot of dry vegetation, more than normal, and it's just being lit up as embers from really fast-moving winds, known as Santa Anas locally, spread those embers throughout the area. So, you know, here we know it's a little bit more than 50 acres. If you go to Ventura County, which is about an hour north of where I'm standing right now by car, you know, it's 65,000 acres, a lot less people in Ventura County, but there's still it's providing the spark that could cause lots of concern for, throughout the region.
Now, you mentioned those winds. I understand that last night water-dropping planes and helicopters were grounded in fighting fires because of high winds. So how are the firefighting efforts going?
Well, they're basically, firefighters are being asked to fight these fires with both hands tied behind their backs because the weather's not helping. We're seeing these unseasonable winds in the Southland. And then on top of it, because there are so many fires, they don't have access to specialty equipment or they can't get help from nearby firefighters. For a long time, Southern California has been a model throughout the country of different jurisdictions working together when there's a fire. But now, you know, for example, here in Los Angeles, they can't turn to their neighbors in Ventura and ask for help because they're fighting their own fires. And San Diego can't send people because there's concern that these fires might spread to San Diego as the winds shift down there. So not only do they not have the equipment and the resources that they need because there are so many fires, the weather is then hampering their ability to use the resources and equipment that they already have. And on top of all of this, it's very steep terrain. These are the hills of Los Angeles, and it just makes it very, very difficult to fight.
Yeah. So last question, John, because, I mean, here we are in December. Peak wildfire season is usually
October.
Oh, is
it December?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the first thing. There's always this question of how is this related to the changing climate. And I don't have the answer. And I think, you know, scientists are always really quick to say, don't put any one event on climate change. But I will say this. I myself have seen at least 5 wildfires in person, 2 of them through traveling, not even covering them as a reporter. 1, the deadliest wildfire in California history. And if you look at the satellite images of California and the West from space this year in a time-lapse fashion, you'll see that for most of the year, the West has been on fire. So this is unseasonable winds, but we are also in a different era of firefighting, and there's serious questions going forward. Do we have the money for it? Do we have the resources for it? Do we have the personnel? Can we stop these from becoming the monsters that they have been this year?
Well, John Sepulvedo is with KQED. He's in Los Angeles today. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
After decades of buying television studios, film studios, 21st Century Fox is looking to sell them off. The Murdoch family, which owns Fox, has courted buyers from Disney to Comcast as they reportedly try to shrink their empire to just 3 channels, Fox TV, Fox News, Fox Sports One. So let's bring in NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik. David, this seems like a big shift. You say it could have big impact on television and film. Why is it such a big deal, and why are they doing it?
Well, it's a big deal because the Murdochs and Fox has been such a big player for call it 30-some years, particularly in television, in film, in distribution. And it's a big deal because Disney, you know, if it's able to capitalize on this opportunity, would really be expanding. You've heard James and Lachlan Murdoch, the 2 sons of Rupert Murdoch, talk a lot about scale, how 21st Century Fox has great scale. And what they're really saying is they're big enough to compete. They can produce great things. They can get it distributed. They can find avenues in TV and streaming and television and film and the like. And they can compete. And what they're really saying is they're not sure they can. They're looking at the $6 to $8 billion a year Netflix is willing to spend on original content. Amazon right behind it with multi-billion-dollar budget. Apple looks like it's willing to enter the fray. They're looking around and saying, maybe we don't have this kind of scale. Maybe we can't really compete on this. Maybe we need to find a narrower future for success.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you say, Disney appears to be on top for now. But this would, you know, make a huge company get even bigger. Talk about regulatory scrutiny, because separately we know the Justice Department is trying to prevent the AT&T Time Warner merger, saying it would harm consumers, weaken competition. Some people think it's just about forcing Time Warner to get rid of CNN, you know, that it's political. So can the Justice Department let this huge potential sale go through for more Trump-friendly, you know, Murdochs when it's hedging on the AT&T and Time Warner one?
You know, I think that's a really great question. AT&T and Time Warner is what's called a vertical integration. That is, it's a huge compression or consolidation of assets, but that they aren't really, by and large, in very direct competition at all. This would be what's called a horizontal integration. That is, people that have a lot of essentially competing parts getting together. You know, Disney would be consolidating things. The presumption is that Fox Broadcasting Network would not be part of this. You know, after all, Disney owns ABC Network. The presumption is that Fox News would not be part of this. Fox Business News would not be part of this. But Disney would get Fox's stake in Hulu and get a controlling interest in that streaming service that essentially competes in some ways with Netflix and Amazon and the like. Disney would not acquire Fox's local TV stations. It owns some of its own in major markets. But there would be a lot of consolidation in the television studio business. For example, Fox not only produces TV shows for its own broadcast network, but Fox Studios produces This Is Us, a big hit for NBC. It produces Modern Family for ABC, which was a big hit over the years. This would be definitely a consolidation. And I think that's something that one would have to question. Is bigger not better? Then why wouldn't this be a problem for regulators as well?
Well, there's that. I just want to turn to a story of sexual harassment, something that Fox has been dealing with Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly. But there's another story coming out. Time Magazine's Person of the Year came out today. It's The Silence Breakers, profiling many women who came out against powerful men. And this story has affected public radio, as we know, but most recently with John Hockenberry, the former host of WNYC's The Takeaway. He has been accused. How do you think NYC has handled this case?
You know, I think we're still learning and figuring out how it's handled the case. They have had to cover it as a news station in the way that we have endeavored to cover it vigorously here, our own issues at NPR earlier. I think more revelations have been coming in recent days that don't reflect well in terms of transparency. You know, if to believe the CEO, Laura Walker, John Hockenberry was not removed for sexual harassment issues, although it seems as though there were numerous complaints about sexual harassment and other harassing behavior. You know, three women of color co-hosts who essentially now say that they or at least two of them have publicly said they were driven off by Hockenberry, and a third under apparently some sort of strictures from saying anything at all publicly. I think there's going to be more concern and more disclosures that have to come out before we have confidence that we understand fully all that's happened there.
Okay. And by the way, just very briefly, we have about 30 seconds. Do you think anything that Fox is doing has anything to do with their huge settlements for sexual harassment charges?
Well, I think that if you look at the fact that Fox has paid probably over Fox and Bill O'Reilly, its former star, have paid over $180 million, if my back-of-the-envelope calculations are correct, to settle a lot of these sexual harassment claims and related claims. That's been a big black eye that's interfered with a major business deal, a $15 billion takeover proposed in Britain. It slowed that down. I think right now they're looking for a way in which to give Lachlan Murdoch a chance to run a smaller Fox and maybe James Murdoch a chance to join Disney.
Oh, NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
There's an astonishing lack of research of the effects of drugs on pregnant women. So that leaves many women who are expecting children in an untenable position, whether to refrain from taking drugs during pregnancy or whether deciding that the risks are worth it. But now a federal task force is trying to help. Joining us with more is Megan Thielking, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Megan, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, first of all, let's just remind everyone why there's so little research today on how drugs do affect pregnant women.
Sure. So there have been these longstanding ethical concerns about exposing pregnant women to medications that haven't been proven as safe and that might put them or their fetuses at risk. It really dates back to this tragedy that happened starting in the late 1950s with a drug called thalidomide that was given to pregnant women for morning sickness and ended up being tied to these really devastating birth defects. There are also a lot of liability concerns about who's responsible if a drug tested on pregnant women does turn out to cause problems. You know, there are regulatory hurdles that make it more difficult for researchers to include pregnant women. And, you know, researchers are really working with a ticking clock, and that makes the research hard, too, because, you know, there's a 9-month time window to locate potential people to participate in your studies, to enroll them, and to run the study. So there's a lot of factors at play.
You know, and it's, of course, the ethical concerns about what the impact could be on the fetus are paramount. But there are other issues as well, such as, you know, obviously women's bodies change significantly during pregnancy. And how does that complicate things?
Pregnancy really changes the body in profound ways. And that it changes everything from your blood pressure to how quickly your digestive system moves to how quickly your renal system clears out waste. And all of those changes can actually affect how drugs get absorbed, how they get distributed. You know, they might not be working in the body for as long. They might be working at too high of a dose or too low of a dose. And we don't really know because doses for drugs are determined using tests on people who aren't pregnant.
So then here comes this new federal task force. What's its mission and how might it help?
So Congress created this task force last year through a piece of legislation called the 21st Century Cures Act, and they really wanted to get at this question of why so few women can really get reliable answers on medication use during both pregnancy and lactation. And so they're tasked with figuring out what the gaps in research are and how we can fix them. So they've brought in doctors and ethicists and people from the drug industry, and they've also brought in pregnant women and mothers to share their perspectives. So the big goal is for them to sort of write up all of their findings and their recommendations and send it off to the federal health secretary. And whoever's serving as health secretary next year needs to start putting those recommendations into action by the end of 2018.
Okay. And so talk to us a little bit more about researchers, because, of course, in the past, they have been discouraged from including pregnant women in their studies, for example. But now they're going to pregnant women will be removed from the regulatory list of vulnerable populations. What does that mean?
Right now, pregnant women are currently listed as an example of a vulnerable population in research. So it's kind of a red flag that you need to take extra special protections with these certain populations. But they're on that list along with prisoners and people with diminished mental capacity. And it's a designation that's designed to protect people who might be at risk of being pressured into participating in clinical research. But some experts say that that's really created this culture where it's assumed that you'll exclude pregnant women from research rather than assuming you'll include them. So the government has actually announced that they're going to take pregnant women off that list of examples of vulnerable populations, and advocates for the change hope that that'll begin to sort of shift the culture in the research community to assume that we will always include pregnant women unless there's a reason to suspect that something might be unsafe for them or their fetuses.
Right. So this is a difficult thing, though, because the tests are going on because we don't know exactly what the outcomes would be with any number of these drugs, though. And so how do you, in terms of changing the culture, how do you deal with the ethical issues that some people will still continue to have, that their basic argument that it's not ethical to include pregnant women in drug trials because you're not just dealing with the woman, you're dealing with the potential impact on the fetus as well?
One argument that's sort of cropped up a lot in this conversation is the idea that, you know, there's been this longstanding thought that it's unethical to test experimental drugs on pregnant women and their fetuses. But a lot of doctors out there are saying it's really unethical not to at this point, because without that research, pregnant women are faced every single day with these decisions. They're taking drugs that haven't been tested as safe and effective. So it's really a bit of an experimental process no matter what. There are other options for researching on pregnant women as well. So researchers could also do more to collect data from children whose mothers took medication while pregnant and sort of look back and just see, not necessarily in a clinical trial, but just to look back at that data and see, was there any increase in birth defects or problems among these children? And, you know, that doesn't necessarily replace a clinical trial to test a medication and see whether it's safe, but it's better than the evidence we have for a lot of stuff that's out there right now.
Well, Megan Thielking reports for STAT. Megan, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
Last week, public radio listeners across the country suddenly stopped hearing this.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, September the 21st.
Minnesota Public Radio and its parent company cut ties with host Garrison Keillor over allegations of inappropriate behavior with a colleague. The sudden disappearance of the Writer's Almanac has left millions of poetry lovers without their daily dose of verse. Nancy Rosenbaum reports.
Joe Mills was really looking forward to having one of his poems featured on the Writer's Almanac. Then he got the news.
So I think this was on Wednesday. My poem was supposed to appear on Friday. And on Thursday, even in the Wikipedia entry, was past tense. So it all happened very quickly.
Mills is a writer who teaches at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. It would have been his 10th appearance on the program.
Here's a poem for today by Joseph Mills entitled Turning. My friend's kid runs.
The Writer's Almanac started in 1993. It was a 5-minute daily broadcast and podcast featuring literary history and musings. The program reached more than 2 million listeners each week, and every episode ended with a poem. This gave it reach unlike any other platform for poetry, and it certainly gave Joe Mills a sense of validation.
Somebody once said, to publish a poem and to wait for a response is like throwing a feather into the Grand Canyon and try to hear it hit the ground. You just don't get much of a response from your work. So the Writer's Almanac was one forum that you actually did get feedback on your work. You would get fan emails, which for a poet is almost unheard of.
Jeff Schatz is executive editor at Grey Wolf Press in Minneapolis. He says that a mention on the show could also give poets and publishers a financial boost. That's no small thing for a poet.
You could track a jump in Amazon sales rank. Sales increased around that poet's work being read.
Jeff Schatz gets thousands of poetry manuscripts every year. A Writer's Almanac credit could set someone apart.
Sure, I took notice of it. I mean, it meant that there was an existing audience for this poet and poem. The Writer's Almanac wasn't just selecting anybody.
Now that the Writer's Almanac has gone dark, nobody is hearing those poems. Fans can't even access past episodes online. That's because Garrison Keillor owns the content and the Writer's Almanac name. In an email, a Minnesota Public Radio spokesperson said, quote, "We know there is a lot of interest among our audience in a new poetry program, so we are energetically looking into what that could look and sound like. For now, this leaves poetry supporters like Jeff Schatz in limbo."
What do we do now? How can we advocate not only for our authors, but for poetry being on the airwaves? Here's an opportunity to shed light on diverse voices, and particularly the voices of women.
Schatz hopes to be part of the conversation about what comes next. It's an opportunity to reimagine what was the Writer's Almanac as a new and fresh outlet for poetry. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Rosenbaum in Minneapolis.
As we make our way to the new year, we'll be looking back at the one passing and the incredible stories that captured our attention until the next one came. Shootings, hurricanes, fires. We're keeping an eye on the fires today in Southern California, but we've been wondering, how are the Shepherds of Redwood Valley in Northern California? They were caught in those devastating October fires. They called friends at about 1 a.m. and said they were going to drive down their long, isolated driveway to flee. The next morning, Mom Sarah and 17-year-old daughter Cressa were found together in the driveway, burned but lucid. 14-year-old Kai was nearby. He had perished. Dad John somehow made it to the hospital. No one was sure how he got there. At the time, we spoke with Sarah's sister, Mindy Ramos. Both of the parents were heavily sedated. Cressa, the 17-year-old, had just had to have her legs amputated. Now, their story is very difficult to hear, but Mindy wanted to give this tender update. Mindy Ramos, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
But I know some tough news. People outside your area may not know. Cressa, your niece, the 17-year-old, did not make it.
No, she succumbed to her injuries on October 29th.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
They were doing a routine bandage change, and they noticed that she wasn't registering any pain. And so they did a scan, a CT scan of her brain, and found out that she her brain was dead, and it likely had been for a couple days. So.
Yeah. Oh, horrific. So two children gone. Do the parents know?
Yeah. So John is much more advanced in his healing just because his burns weren't quite as severe as my sister's. So he's actually made it out of ICU, made it out of rehabilitation, and has been discharged from the hospital.
Oh, wonderful.
So he's walking and talking, and he has very clear memories of the fire. So we actually do know a little bit more now about how he was able to get to the hospital.
Well, can you tell us that? What is he saying?
Sure. Well, they fled the fire in two cars. My sister was in her car with the two kids and one of their dogs. And as they were going down, John was following in his truck with another dog. As they were going down the mountain, they just came to a wall of fire. And my sister knew that she couldn't drive through it. And so she hit the brakes really quickly. And John actually hit her car with his car. And as they were trying to back up, it got hot, so they had to jump out of the cars. Mm. And from what John recalls, they ran essentially like across the space of like, say, a living room. And when they looked back, the cars were engulfed in flames. Mm. Mm. And so at that point, they just really were running from the fire, running around in circles from one wall of flames to another. Everyone was terrified and burning. John actually saw his son. He knew that Kai had passed, and when he saw Kai fall is when John he actually had a little heart attack. When he came to, he saw that Cressa and Sarah were together. You know, whether they were alive or dead, they were together, and he felt he needed to go to his son. So he went to Kai, and he put his hand on him and said some words, but then knew he had to get down the mountain to get some help. Mm. He walked probably about a mile with very severe burns, mostly on his hands, and he walked all the way to the end of the driveway and found the EMTs.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to remember every detail. and being able to talk about it is really helpful. I know for him, you know, my sister's still heavily sedated. She still has at least one more, maybe two more surgeries to go. So while she does know that her children have passed, it's not real clear what she remembers from day to day.
Thank God, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, I mean, it's just, it drives home. You hear fleeing fire. You know, you can make it antiseptic, but it's, you know, it's a horror.
Yeah.
And
horrifying.
And now, you know, they lost the house, which you told us they'd built by hand. Mm-hmm. Where do they go to recover? I mean, what?
Well, right now he's staying here in Sacramento at the Kiwanis house so that he can be as close to Sarah as possible. My parents have a house nearby that he's also welcome to stay at, but he, you know, he has, as he says, he's got to learn how to carry on in this grief. And getting out of the hospital into the real world is going to give him that opportunity to kind of start feeling those emotions and how it's going to feel out here. As far as long term, my parents are building a small, like 1,000-foot square home on their property in Redwood Valley that'll be accessible for Sarah and John if they choose to live there.
And you're doing this in part because of a community that's just responded so to this family. Talk about that.
Yeah, we have the generosity.com fundraiser that people responded to just immediately. And then even beyond that, people wanted to have sort of more tangible ways to show support. And so we have holding up Hope for the Shepherds, you know, bracelets and t-shirts and decals, things for the cars that they just, some friends back home started selling. It's comforting to be able to move around town back home and see everyone with these purple bracelets and know that everyone's still holding them in their hearts.
Yeah, we're going to make sure we link people up again. But John was a carpenter. You mentioned his hands.
Yeah, that's probably his biggest rehabilitation focus right now. He has the use of his hands. The grafting work that they did was exceptional. His hands look really good. But it's a process for him to gain back all the strength, and he works on it every day, all day. There's still quite a bit of pain to deal with as well.
Yeah. What happens? I mean, I'm thinking down the road. What happens when your home burns? Do they own the land? Do they ever want to go back there? I can't imagine going to that driveway.
Yeah, John doesn't think that he ever wants to set foot on the property again. You know, he knows the exact spot where his son died, and to cross that point on the driveway on a daily basis isn't something he can handle. His focus right now, he goes to see my sister every day. He tries to make her laugh every day. And just trying to find a way that the two of them can be happy and continue living is his focus. He's talked a lot about travel. You know, whatever they need to do to survive.
Yeah. What about you, Missy?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Two kids of your own?
Yeah. I've been well supported by a tribe of friends back home in Ukiah that have been taking care of my home and my children off and on for me. It's the holiday season and my kids have had a rough go. I mean, they've lost their two cousins. It's been a difficult year for them in a number of ways, and I feel like I need to be home for the holiday season. So that means I'll be coming to Sacramento likely on the weekends to visit my sister. Yeah.
What do you all do? You can't unknow what you know about fire.
Even, you know, just the other day, I was watching my daughter's dance performance with my son, and they were using dry ice to make that misty effect. Mm-hmm. And my son thought it was smoke, and he was immediately alarmed. You know, and I explained it to him. And even in the ways that, like, the idea of fire can startle my sister, you know, like, they have a red digital clock in her hospital room, and that glowing red reminds her of a fire, so we keep it covered, you know? Mm. It's, you know, I guess I have a healthier fear of fire than I ever had before.
Yeah. And there's this gorgeous, beautiful area, yeah, it's just gorgeous there, that kind of turned on everybody.
Yeah. It's really hard to see. I mean, having grown up in Redwood Valley, the area that was most badly burned was my stomping ground. That's where we hung out when I was a teenager and just running around with friends. And it's really hard to see the burn scars on that valley right now and just the surrounding mountains and how, I mean, I try to keep faith and one of the vineyards out there, one of the wineries, was saying that they were feeling hopeful that this next spring was going to be one of the most beautiful ones we ever had because of the, you know, the wildflowers that would be blooming after a fire like this. And I try to hold up that hope, but yet, like you said, it's like it turned on us. Yeah, the place that once that John and Sarah once went to for solace is now a horrifying place. I've been in a lot of shock since Cressa passed because it's just too much to fully process or understand.
Yeah. It just is unbearable. But there's a lot of people thinking about you, and I hope you feel that.
Yes, we do. We do.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Mindy Ramos. Her sister and brother-in-law, Sarah and John Shepherd, were both severely burned and lost everything, most unbearable, their two children, Cressa and Kai, in the October Northern California wildfires. We'll link you to support at hereandnow.org.
Turkey is one of the countries condemning President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says this is a red line for Muslims, and he's threatening to sever diplomatic ties with Israel. The BBC's Mark Lowen is with us. And Mark, first of all, tell us more about Erdogan's opposition. Why does it exist?
Well, Meghna, President Erdogan very much sees himself as the leader or a leader of the Muslim world. And anything that is seen as a key issue for Muslims, he regularly talks about, he hits out at those who are attacking the Muslim cause. And he believes that he can speak for the Islamic world in opposing Donald Trump's support for Israel in declaring Jerusalem as their capital. Turkey has aligned itself very much with the Palestinians on this issue, but several other issues as well in terms of contested hotspots of Jerusalem and when the Israelis have stopped Muslims from coming up to the Holy Mount and all sorts of things. So it really is a key kind of thing for Recep Tayyip Erdogan to talk about and hit out about. He has invited leaders from the Muslim world to come to Istanbul next week to discuss the issue. As you said, he's warned that he would sever diplomatic relations with Israel. He's absolutely kind of throwing himself into the center of this dispute.
Interesting. So it makes a lot of sense that he might consider himself a spokesperson for the Muslim world writ large. But specifically regarding his threat to sever Turkish diplomatic ties with Israel, what's the significance of that?
Well, I mean, Turkish-Israeli ties, relations have been pretty shaky for some time, specifically since 2010, when Israeli commandos stormed an aid ship bound for Gaza. And Turkey, President Erdogan, Prime Minister at the time, was absolutely furious. Turkey eventually withdrew its ambassador to Israel, to Tel Aviv. And there were no ambassadors actually in Turkey or in Israel for some time. They improved in the last year or so, but because Mr. Erdogan has very much, as I say, sort of taken the Palestinian side on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, the relationship between Israel and Turkey is shaky. That said, there are a lot of Israeli tourists who come to Turkey. They're key trade partners. So it is an important relationship. And of course, they are two big powers in the Middle East. And if Turkey severs diplomatic ties, I suppose yet again, it would have a severe economic impact and a regional impact as well. And clearly a big symbolic move by Erdogan in this Jerusalem dispute.
Right. And so, I mean, essentially what President Erdogan is doing is he's very strongly criticizing President Trump's decision here. So what impact could this have on Turkey's relationship with the U.S.?
Well, Turkey's relationship with the U.S. is arguably at its lowest point, probably since the Cold War, I would say, at the moment. There are a number of disagreements over Syria, over the presence in America of Fethullah Gülen, the Turkish cleric that the Turkish government blames for orchestrating the failed coup last year. The two countries have scaled back the provision of visas at the moment. moment for U.S. nationals coming to Turkey and Turkish nationals going to the U.S. So they are really on the on a different page on a number of issues. And if over this Jerusalem issue with Donald Trump's announcement of recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, it is just yet another kind of red rag to a bull for Turkey's president. And yes, these are two big NATO allies, but at the moment they really do not really seem like allies at all.
And finally, Mark, one more question about something that's going on within Turkey's borders right now. More than 100 academics are currently on trial because they signed a petition calling for a declaration of peace with Kurds. Now, of course, there's a very long-running and intense conflict between Turkey and the Kurds. But what does the trial say about President Erdogan's crackdown, which has been going on some time, but his crackdown on dissent in Turkey?
It's really another sign of how freedom of speech, freedom of thought have been squeezed hugely in Turkey since particularly since the failed coup last year, but really over the last few years. This is 150 academics. It's the first group of 1,128 Turkish academics who signed a petition calling on the Turkish government to cease armed conflict with Kurdish militants that has been going on for the last 2.5 years. President Erdogan hit out at them, called them so-called intellectuals, accused them of treason, and the faculties to which they were to which they belonged, bowed to pressure and expelled them. They are now going on trial for terrorism propaganda. They say that they are, of course, innocent and that they are simply calling for Turkey for peace in Turkey, and they are condemning the fact that children and women were caught up in this conflict and were dying in the conflict. But it's really a sign that academics and intellectuals and opponents of the Turkish government feel incredibly squeezed in today's Turkey, and really critics of the Turkish government say that without freedom of thought, without freedom of expression, without freedom for intellectuals and academics, democracy in Turkey itself is being killed off.
Well, that's the BBC's Mark Lowen. Mark, thank you so very much.
Pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.